Friday, the 14th of November, 2024. This is episode number 14. I incorrectly called episode number 13, number 14 last week. This is actually number 14. Consistently above average, Andrew McGatton here. Some lovely messages off the back of last week's episode. I didn't go through like making a reel and stuff like that last week. I just wanted to share it once, leave it out there, subscribers to find it. Slightly less listeners than usual. Maybe the reel is what prompts some people to do it. I say slightly, it's like less than 10% in terms of the average of the couple of weeks before and stuff like that. So there will be a reel this week, fear not. We'll have to try and navigate through CapCut again. And we've also got some new listeners in new countries, or maybe similar listeners who are just in different countries. I'm not sure. One of them is still Scotland, but it's an island called the Shetland Islands off the northeast coast of Scotland. Somebody listening from there. Tenerife, Indonesia, and Barbados, all joining the map of the world of different places where the podcast has been listened to. It's a sprawling number of locations that is growing. Every couple of weeks, we'll pick up a couple of new countries, so it's nice to see. I have a little scratch-out map in my room that I never used, that my mom got for me about 8 years ago. It's still rolled up, probably longer than 8 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago, about, oh, scratch it off whenever you visit one of these countries. And I think I might just put a pin in them now. I might actually put it up on the wall and scratch it out whenever I get a listener from that country. Could be something. I'm also thinking of redesigning the way my desk is so that I'm facing a wall instead of facing out to the back of my room. Because I have a couple of things that I would like to put into frames and hang up as memorabilia. And just maybe thinking with one eye on the future, do I want to turn it into like a little corner of a desk of a show of a production? Not sure 100% just yet, but we'll see. Anyway, let's jump into jiu-jitsu specific for this week. Last week weren't as specific on jiu-jitsu. So on Sunday just gone, we had a great day's training in Newry. 47 people came to train with us in the Gi. It was a little soft launch for our cross-training sessions for the Gi Europeans in January. Some new faces joining us, some old faces returning. Lots of specific training as well. Very good feedback from some of the other higher belts and coaches who came, how we could try and improve it for the next couple of sessions. We have taken the notes on board. We are absolutely going to be implementing them just in terms of how we can get more from the time that we have together. So very much looking forward to the next one of those, which all going to plan is going to be in November or early December. Will be confirmed, poster release, different stuff like that within the course of the next week. This is an open call. You don't have to be competing at the Gi Europeans if you want to come and train at this session. Yes, we may regret that when the numbers exceed a certain amount in the future, but we just want to try and get as many good people willing to train hard together on the mat at the same time for 2 hours on a Sunday, if possible. And just on that point, without sounding narky at all, this is coming from a very genuine place, that we've made a conscious decision that enough different people have come to the five different sessions and they've enjoyed it, that we don't really need to like nudge or try and encourage more people. That's not to say that more people aren't welcome. For different reasons, people haven't been able to make it, something come up, life gets in the way, all of those things, totally fine. And I think, without jinxing it, I think that we've fostered a good enough atmosphere, energy, relationships and trust with these people who feel like it's worth them coming to train when they're able to do that. And if they can make the dates in the future and they can come and train, perfect. This is like an opposite to the law of attraction. We're not chasing it. We're not chasing it, anyone. Do you know what I mean? Just this is the date. If you can make it, perfect. If not, dead on. We wanted to try and get as many people from as many different gyms as possible. We have done a good number of that. Of course, we are always going to be open to people from other gyms, other teams, other whatever who want to come. So maybe if you haven't been to one yet and you're thinking, oh, well, I didn't go to the other ones, so I can't go now. Yes, you absolutely can. We'd love to see you there, hopefully at the next one. By the time that this episode has been released, even though it's quite late again, Thursday into Friday, I keep doing that, but we're in a routine of it now at this stage. But I meant to be in the gym in the morning. Showed up to a gym on Wednesday morning with cash, ready to sign up for a couple of months. Card only. Got as far as the door, did a U-turn. My mate slept in. We'll shame him for that. He slept in, although he did think we were going tomorrow, Friday, instead of Wednesday. So now there is a chance that I'm going to sleep in tomorrow, then I'll look like the arsehole, and then we'll be one all, and then we can start properly on Monday. But fingers crossed, I will be up in a couple of hours. When this podcast is out, should be there. Big Gene over in Abu Dhabi, going through his bracket at the AJP World Pro at the same time, competing tomorrow morning, today, Friday the 15th of November, on a collision course for a big, big match with Felipe Andrew in the semi-finals. All going to plan if they both get there, and that will be some match. I think I'm going to have to pay for the stream. I think you have to pay for the AJP stream. Definitely worth it considering the production value, and would be keen to keep an eye on other divisions anyway, because there's a lot of good people competing over in Abu Dhabi this week. As well, another Irish athlete, Zara from East Coast, is going to be competing in the brown black belt division as well at 62 kilos. I know the Carmody's were over there as well earlier on in the week. My teammate Aaron Devlin also went over as well. So a decent number of Irish competitors heading over to that, and John and Zara will be on tomorrow. So if we get into the technical element of jiu-jitsu, I want to talk about trying to address some holes in your game and how you can patch them up. All right, so we're going to look at this from two perspectives, both as the individual competitor and as someone who's coaching people, and how you would help them patch holes in their games. So let's use this example from my own experience here. I can't control how people are going to roll with me in the gym. I have an idea of what they might try and do, considering that we're regular training partners. But outside of directly asking them, do something that they're not used to, I need to figure out ways to funnel them into that area that I'm looking to improve on. So at the Nogi Europeans, I got into a bit of bother in one of the matches with a person constantly passing to one side, which would be my left-hand side, aka his right-hand side. There really shouldn't be a good or bad side when it comes to jiu-jitsu at a higher level. And while I feel my guard is good defending on both sides, I feel my attacks are lacking on one side more than the other. And that was just due to the nature of how much I was in those positions in training. So people are always going to have preferences. Because I'd been focused in one area of my guard in the lead up to the competition, it was neglected in the sense of what my reactions and options were going to be when the person forces the passing to one specific side. So different things that I have done in the last couple of weeks in training to get more exposure and to rectify that is the way that I've been positioning myself in my seated guard, my guard entries to different situations to try and encourage them, if they are going to try and pass, to pass to the side that needs work on more. Even if that means there's a very boring or like jabbing type of open guard exchange where they're attempting to work onto their preferred side, but I'm creating space, not overcommitting, not accepting their entries and just working off my usual side, instead of making them maybe feel a little bit frustrated and like that their best move is to just proceed with the situation that they've been given, which is the situation that I want to work on. And that's a way that you can try and funnel them into that sort of area. Now, it is definitely a work in progress, and that's quite a broad example in terms of not wanting to be too specific. But in my opinion, I've found it much easier to try and help somebody else through a coaching perspective plug or patch holes in their game instead of me fixing them myself through my own rolling and sparring. Now, it's very stereotypical to say something like no one role is ever the same, but I generally feel that there are three elements or three types or styles of rounds that I've experienced as a black belt in the last year and a half. One is a person who's beaten already and is unsure and unassertive of their steps. They think that they are resigned to defeat already because you are a certain rank and they are a certain rank. So they will react, defend, tighten up, stiffen up to your movements and your entries, happy to stay on the back foot, but focusing on trying to negate or cancel what you're doing instead of trying to make forward progression themselves. Now, that's completely fine to train that way. You have to train that way to a degree until you have that breakthrough or one or two moments of belief that something can actually work on this person that you think it's unworkable on. We've talked about this before, whether it's surviving for a little bit longer, defending a sweep, defending a submission, passing somebody's guard for the first time. Until that happens for the first time, you're going to find it harder to believe in it and believe in themselves in terms of them being able to do it. Okay, so that's one type of archetype of role. Another could be maybe, for example, with a similar rank belt who's not training for competition, recreational trainer. You and them are training for exploratory or recreational means, like it's just an exchange of jiu-jitsu. Both people in this sense are happy to engage wherever the role is going to end up. It's a form of catch and release. Neither are going 100% trying to like outdo and submit the other. There's no like aggression. It's just technical, good flow, good back and forth. We don't care where we're going. A competitive flow role to a degree, but we're working through positions. And I have talked about this before, that if I'm attending a class versus attending a competition class versus coaching at a class that I'm also training at, my goals or objectives are going to be different depending on what class I'm at. If it's a lighter session and I'm at a class someone else is teaching, I might try and pick one or two things that I can work on. Specific guard recovery from this position, trying to create off balances from places I wouldn't normally be good at doing them from, maybe even work in submission defense. Compared to if you're at competition training, you're trying to get to play and succeed at your best positions, work towards accumulating a points total and then submitting them. The reality is that if you're then also in the third option, like training at a class that you're teaching at also, there are people at that class or at these classes, at least in my experience, who might only be able to train once or twice a week. And they might only be able to get to your classes for a while, someone else's classes for a while. So to a degree, they are relying on your class and maybe your input around their development. And of course, they're going to look to roll with you. I know from being the lower belt that you're always going to want to try and train with the higher belts. So it's completely understandable. And I'm glad that we don't have this rule in our gym that's like, oh, it's disrespectful to ask a higher belt to roll. No, ask the best people to roll. That's how you're going to get better. That's how you're going to enjoy it more. And I think that the job of the person who's coaching, when they're, there's plenty of other ways that this can be looked at. So I'm not saying that this is the right way. But in that example that I'm given, if I'm training with these people, like there are people who will do it in a certain way, and I respect that, and I just don't have that in me. And I probably should have had that in me from a longer period, but this is just the way that I am now. Like, I won't let somebody pass my guard, but there are people who train in a certain way. It's like, if you ever score a point on me, it will be earned. Like, I will not concede a sweep. I will not concede a guard pass. I will not concede this attack. I will not do this. They're always going to give you their A game. They're always going to shut you down and stuff like that. I do think that is important. I don't roll that way all the time. But if I am training with someone at a lower rank and I'm also teaching them at a class, then I'm going to try and roll through three varying degrees of intensity when I am training with them. And I feel that this is the way that I gauge their progress and try and help them improve. I could be right or wrong with this. I really don't know. I'm open to hearing different sides of things. I could be doing it. I could be making a hams of it, as we would say. So I need to be able to roll slightly below their level so that they can work. I also need to be able to roll at their level so that they're tested. And then I need to roll slightly above their level so that they're challenged under duress. So there should be three phases, in my opinion, that I will roll with lower belts if I'm teaching at the class. Again, that's if I'm teaching at the class, I'm going to try and roll with the lower belts in three different phases. However, if I am training at a class and I'm rolling with those same people, then I'm going to roll with them a little bit differently. So how I'm going to roll with, say, a master's female competitor who's quite light is going to be different to how I'm going to roll with the 95 kilo CrossFitter who has started jiu-jitsu a year ago and is like 8 years younger than me. They're going to be two different outputs from me entirely. Rolling with somebody in this way, in my opinion, allows you to be able to see and correct their mistakes a little bit more efficiently because you haven't shut their game down entirely. You've got to see what they're good at, what they're trying, what they're wanting to try and express with their jiu-jitsu and where it could use a little bit more work. It also gives you those notes to take away afterwards for how you might structure their development or their positional sparring more in the future. One lad this week, for example, was having a lot of trouble with knee shield from half guard. So I just told everyone who's starting to roll with him to go from that position in every round so they would get more exposure to solving that particular problem in a round of sparring. And I will continue doing that with them probably for the next 2 or 3 weeks. And then we'll come back and see, is this still a problem? Do we need more technical information or what's the story with it there? And I really don't know if that is right or wrong. I am still getting used to coaching in that sense of what's going to work for some people will not work for others. And I suppose I could, when I'm coaching, I can phrase a scenario to people in the certain way, like I said above. I want you to pass to this person's left-hand side because they keep getting passed on that side. And I would counter and tell the other person, use this round to work on retaining your guard on the side that you keep getting passed on and try and use the details that we did to help that. I feel that when I'm coaching, I can ask two people to roll that way because I'm trying to get them better. When I'm training, I feel like I selfishly cannot ask the other person, oh, will you just do this? Because they're there maybe to train as well themselves. That feels like I'm, feels demented, feels like I'm not explaining that properly. There's probably a more efficient way of doing that. I'm not sure. But in theory, I would hope that my other idea of telling one person to do this, telling the other person to prepare for it, is going to give both of those people chances to improve in the areas that they're potentially weak in. And now while explaining that, on a tangent, as usual, I did leave out the third option of a person who you could be training with, and that is the type of person who will absolutely go all out for your blood, no matter what. They want to try and get you, they're willing to go hard, they're going to be aggressive in those rounds, and no matter what belt level they are, assuming they're not trying to hurt you, like do something like insane, and that they're going to give you the opportunity to tap if they get you, they are the ones where you as the athlete are going to start patching the holes in your game quicker. Much like the way that I said that there are three ways to roll with people as a coach, I think there's also three perfect types of training partner you need in your gym as a competitor. Someone below your level, someone at your level, and someone above your level. Someone above your level makes you tune everything up so finely that you're able to patch your weaknesses and survive for longer in bad positions that they're able to put you in. Someone at your level is able to work on exposing and enforcing your game against someone who is aware of it. It's also a very challenging round. Like, there is one particular person I train with that they will either beat me, hockey me, or I will maybe steal 2 points or win on advantages and have the round of my life. It's one or the other. It is literally a toss of the coin over what's going to happen, and it's usually who gets to their best position first. And then you can have someone below your level who's game and trying to kill you so that your transitions can become more fluid and effective for when, like in a competition against the same level or same belt rank that you're competing against that doesn't know your game could hopefully be caught by your traps. So the over energetic purple or blue belt who will go side to side like mad and throw recklessly into their guard passing, that can give you the opportunity to get better at catching submissions, catching counters, flowing into stuff. This is air quote marks here, doing black belt stuff that they feel, oh, how did he catch me with that? That's how you work your timing. And then hopefully you get so good and so comfortable in those timings thanks to the rounds with the lower belts that when it comes to competing against people at your level that you're able to set those traps and catch them as well. So it is a tightrope. It's one that I'm getting a little bit better with. Still have a lot to improve on. And a shout to Dara O'Connell, who has excellent reels on his Instagram, but he had something recently that said a coach can essentially be in charge of a class of 30 or 40 people. Competitors should be coming to training with a task or with a purpose, a specific idea of what it is that they want to be getting better at that day. There are different models in jiu-jitsu for class structure and stuff, including like reverse classroom model, but at the end of the day, the athlete's improvement is going to be guided by a coach, but it's not going to be down to the coach day in, day out to spoon feed everything to them. This is what you need to do. This is what you need to do, blah, blah, blah. You're going to get that to some degree, but a lot of the work has to be done yourself outside of the mat, studying, coming in with a plan, influencing it. The coach will not be able to watch every single one of your rounds, every single good thing you do, every single bad thing you do. And it is something that I found quite hard over the last year or so, between balance and training sessions, preparing for competitions, coaching classes, being a general cool guy outside of jiu-jitsu. Like, those things are pretty tough. They're all spinning plates, and honing in and focusing on one can mean sometimes you're taking your eye off the others. So I find that's why our cross-training sessions and going to other gyms can be so useful, because you're able to just go and train, you're in for a tough one, and you know the level of the people that are showing up. So I feel there are ways that you can patch areas in your game. It has well and truly taken 14 episodes and now roughly about 22 minutes in this episode for me to talk about a professional level MMA fight that is happening this weekend. Just when I thought I was out, many, many years later, they have dragged me back in. John Jones is fighting Stipe Miocic this weekend at UFC 309. The card looks good. I'm going to stay up all night on Saturday to watch it. Like, no doubt I'm going to end up doing that. I still heavily consume the media and content landscape of the MMA world, even if I don't watch every single UFC event. I have several friends that are still working in it in a full-time capacity. A lot of stuff, podcasts, YouTube channels, tweets that I like following and listening to every week. And I found it so amazingly funny at this John Jones return. He has rattled absolutely everybody with his downright refusal to even publicly acknowledge or consider the possibility of fighting Tom Aspinall. Even citing that in one of his interviews this week, oh, they finally found a guy who's 7 years younger, 30 pounds heavier, and everyone just wants to see him lose because he's the best ever. Now, if they didn't want to see you lose before that, considering how popular Tom Aspinall is, they do want to see you lose now after this week. And he has created such an almighty buy-in to his next fight. People are going to be watching this fight with a vested interest over what his next move might be, which is the equivalent of printing money for yourself. He hasn't even stepped in with one of the best heavyweight champions that the UFC has ever produced in the form of Stipe, who I actually think has a great chance of beating John Jones this weekend, for what it's worth. I do think Jones is going to win, but I think Stipe has had possibly the best chance in a long, long time that anyone has against John. So let me just set up my stall here as we round off the show. I do believe that the current interim UFC heavyweight champion in the form of Tom Aspinall is going to go down on his current trajectory. Loads of things could go wrong, but on his current trajectory, he's going to go down in history as one of the best MMA heavyweights and possibly MMA fighters of all time. He has so many attributes that he excels at as a heavyweight in terms of his boxing, his grappling, his athleticism. Like, it's nearly like we're going to see a longer version of what Cain Velasquez was really, really good at in the form of Tom Aspinall. I can remember 2021 getting a little bit of heat from people for saying that Aspinall was going to put Andrei Arlovsky down gently and then submit him. Ended up happening. We had a fiver on it. We were delighted. Probably still down overall in terms of the obscure submission bets in UFC history, but that is my game. And considering how much more evolved the sport is, how much more like athletes all of these athletes are now compared to 15 years ago. I think that Aspinall's current run to getting that belt and getting the title is similar to, but is more impressive than the run that John Jones took to beating Shogun for the light heavyweight title all of those years ago in 2011. That being said, outside of this sort of sick perversion to a degree that we have with the sport of MMA, that we nearly don't want anybody to get out alive, for want of a better word. We don't want to see somebody retire on their terms with their records intact. I know that we say that we want that for guys, but we're all watching, hoping BJ Penn could do it one more time. Tony Ferguson could do it one more time. We will erase the previous 6, 7, 8 losses if they get to just be themselves one more time and call it quits at that. It's just not how MMA works. We've all had to see our favourites treated like a line from an Eminem song, and that is chewed up, spit out, and booed off stage. Father Time will catch up with them eventually. The next big thing comes along, they take their aura, and then the cycle continues. That is what MMA has always been, and there are so few exceptions to that rule. It's why John Jones is in such a serious position at the moment. If he wants to, and just for the record, I don't believe for a second that he does want to retire after this weekend. He has the ability to walk away on Saturday night, drop the title, vacate it, say, that's me done. I just, depending on if he beats Stipe in emphatic fashion, he can say, I just dusted the best guy of the last couple of years, and that's me done. You would be hard-pressed to argue against him being the greatest MMA fighter of all time. As John Jones said in an interview, you can't get turned down by a girl that you never tried to chat up. In terms of, nobody has said to him in an official capacity about fighting Tom Aspinall, so he can't be considered ducking him if he has never had a fight to turn down with him. And if he retires before they can offer him a fight, then what is he ducking? He has just decided, like he said, 7 years older, that he claims Aspinall is 30 pounds heavier than him, and that he would rather fight, again, hilarious move, Alex Pereira, a guy closer in size, closer in age, a fight that I actually would love to see as well, to be honest, probably maybe even more than Jones versus Aspinall. Like, in terms of John Jones, with the exception of that errant elbow, the 12-6 elbow that got him a loss on his record against Matt Hamill, which may or may not end up being overturned, this man has won 18 fights in a row. He had won 19, one of them was turned to a no contest due to a failed drug test. But if you don't count the illegal elbow DQ, then he has actually won, and you don't count the no contest, then he has actually won 28 or 29 fights in a row. This is the greatest record in mixed martial arts history, without a doubt. This is far better than Khabib's 29-0 record. Like, John Jones turned professional, pro MMA fighter, in April 2008. He was 6-0 as a professional fighter by July of 2008. He fought in April, his first fight, let's say, and then he fought a week later. Two knockouts, two finishes, 7 days apart. He then debuted in the UFC in August of 2008, the same year. We are talking about a guy who went from debutant, April 2008, to signed UFC fighter, August 2008. We're not talking about a guy who had strange two-round fights that were counted as pro fights, or a guy who, when he was 10 or 11 and 0, fought an 0-2 guy, then a 1-1 guy, then a 5-2 guy, then an 0-0 guy to boost his record up to 14 and 15 and 0. John Jones's record, in my opinion, not that my opinion is worth too much anymore, is legit. He's had controversies. He has had huge ones. More than anybody in the sport, outside of the octagon, his life has been covered with a litany of issues that will legitimately tarnish his reputation and willingness for people to support him and get behind him and saying, like, this guy's the best ever. But you also have to take a side into considering that this is a sport where these people did not get into it to be called role models to begin with. If they were like genetic freak athletes, and I do think that they are to a certain degree in terms of their commitment, but if they were genetic freak athletes, they would have been doing other sports making them a lot more money. There is something different, something gone, something demented, whatever word you would like to include in that, something is not present in the person to pursue this sport of mixed martial arts from a professional aspect. The risks are now well documented. Like, this is an insane thing to get into. And if they were, like, if they were looking for something, they would do another sport. But they're looking for something to be filled through fighting, and that's what they're going through. So what I'm trying to say is like, nobody has ever gone out on their own terms. So I do believe that this is all publicity from John Jones, as he's giving himself the option to go out on his own terms. But I also think that he's just trying to make whatever his next move is to be the most profitable possible decision for him in the long run. Like, declaring that he was even prepared to vacate the world title if he retains it this weekend and would only go for fights that improve and add to his legacy instead of the young up-and-comer and the, well, 30-year-old up-and-comer in the form of Tom Aspinall. Like, he definitely would relish the challenge of fighting someone like Tom, but I think he's also thinking, but I have the chance to get out of Dodge. I have the chance to get out here, record intact, money made, and leave the door open by winding and riling them up here to the point of distraction, so that if I do come back, it's going to be huge. And of course, with John Jones, it's always going to be huge. And it's like, he is, from that like perversion of what I said, of we wanting to see the people that we put on pedestals then go out in a certain way, it's nearly like he is denying, and I think this would happen, he's denying Tom Aspinall the chance to do to him what he did to Shogun in 2011. This is a man who's not following the set script. He is trying to change the ending of the script that we all know. Thank you for tuning in. Throw us a few stars there on Spotify. Share it to your story. Tell a friend, tell a training partner, tell an enemy. Enjoy your weekend, and I will chat to you next Friday. Good luck.